Welcome, everybody. I think we can start now, although there are still a few people coming in. It's lovely to see so many people, and the whole meeting has quite a nice old feeling about it, especially since on the way here, I was bearded by students to ask me if I would speak at the occupation on Thursday.
So was I.
So, that's even better. And as you know, this meeting is to launch Mike Newman's book on Ralph Miliband Band and to remember him. I actually only met him twice, and the first occasion was when I was a student at Oxford, and I was editor of the student magazine Isis. And for my last issue, I decided to have a special issue on socialism. And as we were Bevanites, we decided to take the whole editorial team to Ebba Vale. Unfortunately, I didn't get permission from my college, who rang up my mother and said, "Did you know your daughter did not sleep in her bed last night?" My mother, who was a lifelong socialist and my advisor on the project, said, "Of course not, she was in Ebba Vale." This didn't mollify Somerville, who did what was called gating me. That's to say, I was sent down for a week. And since my sister was at LSE, I came here for the week and I interviewed Ralph Miliband for the special issue of Isis on socialism. And he was very kind and very nice, and it was a very productive week. So now I'd like to turn over to Mike just to tell you a little bit about today's events.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Well, my role is really just to say a few words about Ralph Miliband and something about tonight's event. I have to say, keep my remarks very short about Ralph Miliband, and this reminded me of the last time I had to speak about Miliband in a very few words. This was one of the most bizarre events of writing the book. I'd been in North America interviewing people about Miliband. I'd been in Canada for a couple of days, and I arrived at Boston Airport. And I was greeted by an immigration official who said, I won't try and do an American accent, but he said, "Good morning, sir." So I said, "Good morning." And he said, "Are you here on vacation or is it business?" So I said, "Not exactly either. I'm here because I'm doing interviews for a book I'm writing." And he said, "Oh, really? So what's the book about?" So I said, "It was about a person." And he said, and who was this person? And at this point, I started getting cagey. And he said, he was a political thinker. And he said, "Oh, really, sir? What sort of political thinker was he?" So I said, "Well, his name was Ralph Miliband, and he was a political thinker." And he said, "Well, I did poli-sci at Syracuse University, and I've never heard of your Mr. Miliband." What sort of political thinker was he? So I said, "Well, he was a socialist." And he said, "A socialist?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "And is that an interesting or important doctrine anyone should want to know about?" And I said, "Yeah, I think it's very important." And he looked at me as if I was completely mad, but let me in, realizing I was harmless too. Anyway, I was thinking about him and thinking it's a pity he's not here, really, to see that there are a few people interested in my Mr. Miliband and even more interested in socialism. So just a few words about Miliband. He arrived in Britain, a refugee from Nazi-occupied Belgium, arrived as a 16-year-old. And I think that this has relevance because although Miliband wrote more about Britain than any other country, in a sense, he was always writing about it as, to some extent, an outsider. When he wrote about the Labour Party, which, of course, he did in one of the most influential books, critiques of the Labour Party there's ever been, Parliamentary Socialism, it was very clearly not someone who'd been moulded by Durham Miners galas, but someone who had already started off as some kind of continental Marxist, or someone who was steeped in a Marxist tradition, although he was only 16 when he arrived in Britain. On the other hand, if we try to look at what sort of thinker he was, his Marxism, if it was Marxism, was of a very independent kind. He always called himself an independent Marxist. And if people said that his work, other Marxists said that his work wasn't really Marxist, that wasn't anything that bothered him too much, because he always saw it as a framework of analysis rather than a Bible. If you try to say what sort of a thinker, what sort of a socialist was he, there are a lot of paradoxes. He was someone who always, on the one hand, argued that you needed a political party to bring about fundamental change, but he was never somebody who was happy in a party. He was in the Labour Party for a while, but left in the mid-60s and was really never in a party again. It's also, if you think about him in terms of most traditions, he doesn't fit very easily. It's much easier to say what he's not than what he is or was. He was clearly not a social democrat because he regarded social democracy as a timid version of reformism, which was fundamentally not going to change anything. But he certainly wasn't a communist either. He was a critic of communism, both in its established forms and in political parties in the West. Nor was he ever a Trotskyist or Maoist, and he always believed that socialism had to be combined with democracy, and he didn't believe that those forms were ever going to have great relevance to liberal democracies, however inadequate he saw liberal democracy as being. But nor was he a real proponent of movement, spontaneity, what became associated with May 68. Not that he was against it, but he never thought it was adequate or something that was really going to bring about fundamental change. That makes him sound as if he was a skeptic who didn't, who was more critical than he was positive, but I think that would be false as well. He was somebody who actually was constantly trying to learn from experience, apply his own form of thought to contemporary reality, and to project the importance of some kind of socialist democracy. And I think he did that with great courage all the way through his life. That really brings me on to tonight's event. His very final book, which was published after he died, just after he died in 1994, was called Socialism for a Skeptical Age. It was a book that he wrote after the collapse of the Soviet Union and those kinds of regimes. It was also actually a book that he wrote after it appeared that the left was in decline and social democracy was becoming more right-wing. It was an incredibly honest book, I think, which really tried to do what he'd done all his adult life, which was to apply his thought to the present and think about lessons from the past and how socialism in a democratic form could be built in the future. It was a book which should have provoked a debate, but it didn't really provoke a debate at the time. And it was for that reason, when thinking about this event, that it seemed that to have a debate on the title of his last book, Socialism for a Skeptical Age, would be the most appropriate thing to do to commemorate him. And I'm very, very grateful for the really distinguished panel who are going to debate that. I just have one more couple of words to say, and that's about this event. I want to thank very much David Held and the other members of the Miliband Committee for putting on this event. Also, Salome van Jaarsveld for organising so much of it, and also Alan Revel for organising so much of the event. And I want to end with one more controversial point, perhaps Paul's rushing in. I want to say how glad I am that it's at LSE, and I think that it should be at LSE, but also to make one final remark about that. Miliband was really formed to a great extent by LSE. He was a 16-year-old, as I said, when he came to Britain. He came to LSE when he was 17. It really transformed him from a refugee into, over time, a major international theorist. He had thought that he would stay at LSE for the rest of his life, until the mid-60s, where he was a senior lecturer by then. But he was totally alienated by the reaction of the LSE authorities of the time to the handling of the student protests of 68. And eventually he left LSE very disillusioned and upset by it. And I think that was a great shame. And I think it's particularly appropriate that this event actually is at LSE in this theatre, and perhaps it's some kind of posthumous reconciliation. Anyway, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mike, and certainly what I'd like to say, if you like, in defense of LSE, is that for me, coming here, it was wonderful to see that the idea of being a public intellectual, which Harold Lasky and Ralph Miliband had pioneered, is something that is still very much valued at LSE, when it's much less valued at other universities. So let me now turn to our panel of speakers on this exciting issue. And we're going to start with Leo Panitch, who's the editor of Socialist Review, and the something research chair in political economy at York University.
Thank you, Mary. I'm editor of the Socialist Register, which is rather more important than getting the name of the chair right. Let me first of all congratulate Mike Newman on having written a really very, very fine biography of Ralph. He deserves enormous credit for producing such a very fine book. And let me say that I'm very pleased to be here and to see so many people here. I must say, back in 68, when I would have been sitting up at the back there, the people who are now trying to get into the room would not have been nearly as polite to the ushers as they're being tonight. To turn to the theme we've been given to address, socialism in a skeptical age, or for a skeptical age, let me first of all question the premise. I don't believe we live in a skeptical age. Of course, it's skeptical, disillusioned, cynical about socialism. But in other respects, it's the furthest thing from a skeptical age. We live in an age of naive credibility about markets, failing to see that markets represent social relations that are full of power. We live in an age that shows, I would have been listening to Richard Cooper back in 1968, who would have been down here spurring us to revolution. He's just walked in. We live in an age of remarkable naivete about the stock market, about its ability to keep on bubbling. We live in an age of remarkable credulity with regard to tax cuts and supply-side economics. And we live in an age of naive credulity in a number of isolated models, which we are told work well and we should emulate. And especially the people of the South are told work well and we should emulate. South Korea, unbelievably today, Argentina. We live in an age when we are told that we now know the solution to poverty in the South, and when the cure is named as foreign direct investment. Or, for those of us of a more social democratic persuasion, who are more skeptical of markets, we live in an age when we think we can square the circle. When there's no bother at all balancing market efficiency and social justice. when hard choices don't have to be made because you can have both. We live in an age when we think the new economy has done away with capitalist crises. We live in an age when we think through shareholder values we can get at class harmony. We live in an age when we think that the Swedish or the German models are not being undone by financial capital. And we live in an age of remarkable credulity regarding the nature of American intervention for human rights purposes. All of this is the flip side of skepticism about socialism. If you give up on that, you don't become clear-sighted. You take on other illusions. So then what does it mean to think of oneself as a socialist in this kind of age full of illusions about capitalism? It first of all means, and it has always meant this for serious socialist analysis, thought. It first of all means using socialist concepts and ideas to pierce the veil of illusions, to see through the emptiness of surface appearances, to venture out into the dark to banish illusion. When Ralph Miliband wrote The State and Capitalist Society, he was, consciously or unconsciously, writing a response to Anthony Crossland's The Future of Socialism. And Anthony Crossland's Future of Socialism, if you go back and read it today, written in 1956, had three central premises. Number one, that the working class or the labor movement had become a power in the land whose power would never be reversed. Number two, that the state, which before the war had been a handmaiden of business, was now independent of business. And number three, that financial capital was no longer the dominant fraction of the business class. Each of those premises, of course, look ludicrous today. And Ralph set out in The State of Capitalist Society to disprove them. In doing that, he was using socialist analysis in the sense of which I'm speaking. But at the same time, that type of socialist analysis, of skeptical socialist thought, needs to be applied to socialism as practice itself. And that's something that Ralph always did and always taught. He was skeptical of the worth of Marxist analysis as it had been handed down to us, and dedicated himself to developing it in its weakest areas. And that's what Marxism in Politics was all about, the best book, in my view, he ever wrote. I remember visiting him in his rooms across the road when he came back from the Soviet Union on one trip. I'm not sure if it was 1969 or 70. And he said to me, "Do you know why they don't have any cafes in the Soviet Union?" And I mumbled something about planning, central planning. And he said, "No, that's not it at all. Cafes is where are where revolutions are hatched." So many of us, having grown disappointed with Soviet communism or Chinese communism, naively then got on the bandwagon of Cuban or Nicaraguan or what have you. Ralph never did. Never. That's not to say that he didn't wish them well, wasn't inspired by struggles of the kind that led to successes there, but always undertook a sober analysis of the limits of those practices and of those regimes. The best essay he ever wrote, in my view, was his essay criticizing the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. What in a positive sense, however, does it mean to be a socialist today, in this age? Without the movements certainly in Europe and North America. The working class socialist movements that used to exist and have now, as whether a social democracy or communist movements, run their course, at least in the form that they emerged in the early 20th century. Without those movements, socialism is largely about a vision about how to recreate movement of a socialist kind. It's about the process of education, of the development of popular capacities to analyze the world in such a way as to pierce illusions and to envisage a socialist practice. Until those movements are built again, all the policy prescriptions, all the more or less radical reforms we will advance will not go very far. Does that mean we don't have influence? I don't think so. Mike has, among the photographs in the biography, a remarkable photograph that shows Ralph Miliband's influence in a remarkable way. It is a photograph of a prison protest at the East Michigan State Prison in 1981. You see a bank of bars, the prison doors, and one arm is sticking out of one of them, and in the hand of that arm is the state and capitalist society. Those movements will be built. The victory of the Workers' Party this weekend in Brazil, a party that didn't exist 20 years ago, that explicitly emerged as a post-communist and post-social democratic socialist party, is evidence that the illusions that we have had about capitalism will not be sustained forever, least of all in the South. That said, I'm very proud to say that in this current volume of the Socialist Register, there is an essay by a Brazilian called the Porto Alegre Thermidor, which is about the development of the tendencies that Michel so long ago described as the iron law of oligarchy inside the Workers' Party of Brazil. Ralph would have wanted exactly such an article to be published exactly at this time, not because it means that where Lula will go is closed, but because it means we be sober about how much we have to accomplish within our own struggles, let alone in terms of coping with the markets. Thank you.
Thanks. Now our next speaker is Hilary Wainwright, who's probably known to us all, and she's editor of Red Pepper.
Thanks, Mary, and friends and comrades. I'm really pleased to be here, really honoured. Because Ralph meant a lot to me. I mean, he was both sort of guide and a goad, and a friend and a comrade. I mean, he once told me that I had to take myself more seriously. Sort of took me out on a walk after a dinner and said, look, you know, you've got to take yourself more seriously. So if this talk is a bit serious and long, then blame Ralph. But just to say, echoing Leo's point about the victory of the PT and Lula, it was very kind of strange and exciting experience preparing for this talk, because I was rereading Socialism for a Skeptical Age, and at the same time hearing all the news about Lula, and I was reading the last chapter, and I was thinking, God, how can I scan this and email it to my friends in the PT, because it's a remarkable chapter. It's almost like a sort of guide to what a socialist government, a government that's won electoral office but faces the formidable opposition of the financial markets, the financial institutions, and many parts of the state. So I just wanted to read very quickly, just to give a sense of the way in which Ralph combined this sort of pragmatism in tactics, but sort of resolute, determined, principled sense of moving always in a socialist direction. He says, on the one hand, the government, the socialist government, would want very early on to introduce some of the measures to which it has been committed, and which would be viewed adversely by the business community at home and abroad. On the other hand, the government would also want as much cooperation from business as it is possible to maintain, to obtain. This means that the government will continue for a certain period of time to operate in the context of an economy in which capitalist enterprise played a major role. It also means, among other things, allowing firms an adequate rate of profit, indeed helping them to achieve it. And then he says, a socialist government would have to make very clear that if there was to be any kind of partnership with business and the government, it was the government that would be the senior partner. The president will wear posh suits, and on no account will he shave off his beard. But the most important and sort of innovative part of that chapter, which in a sense sort of not preempted but sort of anticipated what I think is important about the PT, was a paragraph which I think is innovative and far-seeing in that it talks about the importance of alliances with the people, not simply as voters, but as citizens organising to control, to exert democracy over their daily lives, not simply with the organisational wings of the party, but with independent democratic organisations in the community and the workplace. And he puts it like this. He says, in Marxist thought, dual power has always been taken to mean an adversary relation between a revolutionary movement operating in a revolutionary situation and a bourgeois government under challenge from that movement. It is, however, possible to think of dual power in different terms, as a partnership between a socialist government on the one hand and a variety of grassroots agencies on the other. In no way would activists be mere servants of the government. On the contrary, they would have an organised life of their own. And for me, in a way, this is the kind of crunch, or this is the idea I want to develop as being really the crunch of socialism for a sceptical age to some degree, but I think also from the point of view of idealists and people wanting transformation, it's a creatively angry age. It's an age in which people aren't joining political parties, whether socialist parties or other parties, but they are inventing new kinds of collective action to assert democratic control where governments have in effect given up or acquiesced to the pressures of big business, whether global or local. It's based on a recognition that parliamentary democracy is necessary but not sufficient. It sees a deeper participatory form of democracy being rooted in the organisations that people already creating, so not based on some sort of elaborate blueprint, but based on what people are already doing, the ways in which people are already filling the gaps, the democratic deficits left by parliamentary democracy. And it entails the idea that the party can't control those democratic forces, and that the party doesn't have a monopoly of the process of social transformation. And that, in a way, is what I think is the distinctive feature of the Workers' Party and its importance for us. That, in a way, when it's got into office, I don't want to romanticise it, I think this article in Socialist Register is very important, and it's sort of critical and stands back a bit. But I think the important thing about the Workers' Party is that when it's got into office, elected office, the first thing it said, I talked to one of its mayors, and he said, when we get into office, we share power with the movements from whence we came. And that's what they did in Porto Alegre and other cities. They opened up the budgetary process to a process of popular negotiation, which I'll maybe say a bit more about later. I think that's why, in a way, the PT potentially, I mean, it's going to face huge problems, but it's going to be, I think, stronger than sort of populist nationalist parties or purely parliamentary parties. I think what it points to, and I just refer to it because I think it's the most sort of credible, viable sort of example of this, it points to a very different political methodology, a very different approach to the state, to power, to agency and party than that of the mainstream social democratic parties. It's interesting that when Peter Mandelson went over to Brazil, he just couldn't recognise it. I mean, he just, using his rather sort of myopic set of categories, he said Lula is backward, not inconsistent with the third way, therefore, you know, sort of nothing to do with him, you know. And it's, Lula isn't consistent with the third way, but as Tony would probably agree, but I mean, the PT doesn't fit into those old categories, which are what, in my view, govern much of the sort of ideological framework of New Labour. Now, what I wanted to really talk about is what's the importance of this participatory approach, rather than just say it's wonderful, it's great, what's the importance of this participatory approach that you know, the PT exemplifies best, but I mean, many of you are carrying out in your day-to-day politics. I just want to say something about its importance by just giving one interpretation of the past, and then explore some of the positive implications for socialists today, and why it does provide the basis of a rethought kind of socialism. Firstly, in thinking about the past, the question I want to ask is why is it that parties rooted in mass working class organisations, like, let's take the ANC and the British Labour Party. Why parties like that, rooted in really strong, powerful, big working class movements and organisations, why in the end they've let big business get away with so much, you know, so that in South Africa you now have the privatisation of water and electricity, so that the government cannot deliver on the very basic commitments it made. You have a situation in Britain where, okay, there's increased public spending, which is great, but where does a lot of that public spending go? Over 50% of public revenue now ends up in private purses, in the companies that are making private profit. Now, there are all sorts of, you have a situation where parties elected to control big private interests have ended up acquiescing, in effect, almost being controlled by them. Now, there are obviously lots of objective factors explaining this in terms of particularly the last 10 years, the growth of financial powers, the sort of the pressures, the electoral, the sort of feeling that you can only be elected if you acquiesce in the pressures of the financial market. But I think that one's got to recognise that this process has been going on for a long time. I want to quote Bevan, talking about Bevanites. I wrote my thesis on Bevan, so I'm a bit of a Bevanite myself. And I wanted just to quote a remark he made after his first year in government in 45. He said, "In practice, it is impossible for the modern state to maintain an independent control over the decisions of big business. When the state extends its control over big business moves in to control the state." Now, Bevan, you know, was no cynic. He entered Parliament after seeing the limits of industrial syndicalism. He wrote a book, In Place of Fear, which, you know, he probably has read, saying Parliament is a sword at the heart of private property. And, you know, I want to first ask, well, you know, what's the explanation for the blunting of that sword? The traditional explanation, you know, which has sometimes been applied to Bevan himself, is to do with the kind of pressures of Parliament, the sort of flattery, sort of bribery, all those sort of pressures which sap the will of even the most sort of militant socialist. But I want to argue that those, in a way, focus too much on, I mean, they're all factors, but they focus too much on the individual. And I want to really ask what it is about the nature of the relationship between the leadership and the membership in social democratic parties, the way in which the leadership, the politicians, conceive their role and conceive the role of the party and the role of the state, that means that that mass organisation, that potential power, the fact that there is these mass organisations behind that leadership, that never becomes a real source of counterpower, of resistance, of challenge, of bargaining power, even with big business, with the big corporations. And my argument is really that, in a sense, it's the conception of the state and of the party as an agency of change that underlies social democracy, that explains this, and the understandings of knowledge that go with this. A sort of understanding of the state as acting almost above society, not in the moral sense, but in the sense of being outside society, of the state being like a sort of engineer acting on society as the sort of raw material to change. I mean, people talk about the social engineering state, and I think that was, in a way, an accurate conception behind a lot of the thinking of social democracy on the centre as well as the left. And that behind that is a particular understanding of knowledge, which, I mean, you know, was very sort of, you know, was positivistic knowledge that was the common sense understanding of knowledge. But it, in terms of politics, it meant an understanding of society, or the understanding of the knowledge of society as being laws, scientific knowledge, codified knowledge, knowledge which almost by definition could only be in the hands of the experts, could be centralized in research departments, in the sort of expertise of the leadership of the state apparatus. But it had serious political consequences. It created effectively a division of labor between the leadership and the masses, which Michels and so on has described, though he doesn't explain it in that way, because he sees it as an inevitable sort of law, rather than based on this, well, I think this is one factor, this particular understanding of social scientific knowledge. I mean, it sees, in a way, the politicians and the state experts as the knowing agents of change, and the mass membership as the supporters of change. So there's no sense of the mass of members, the mass of trade union activists, the people that play their dues or whatever, of being, you know, the active agents of change. They pass resolutions, they have opinions, but the idea that they are knowing agents of change. I mean, Beatrice Webb once summed it up in a quote that's probably familiar to you. She said, the average man or woman can describe the problem but cannot prescribe the solution. That's up to her, people like the Fabians or whoever it is. But the other serious consequence is that in practice, of course, in government does depend on a huge amount of practical knowledge. Government can't be run simply on the basis of social scientific laws. But in the absence of a conscious recognition of the importance of practical knowledge and a searching after the forms of practical knowledge for transformation, in the end, governments end up relying on the practical knowledge of those that are managing the status quo. So, I mean, the experience of Tony Benn here had a big impact on me. Yeah, I'll be very quick. Which is, you know, he came in with a radical industrial policy that would really challenge the major corporations that were causing unemployment and devastation in the Northeast and Liverpool and so on. He came into the Department of Industry and found, of course, that, you know, all his civil servants, all their day-to-day contact, all their practical knowledge of industry was with management. It wasn't corrupt, it was just the way government was, and that was just the way it had been. That's in a way one of the things that Bevan was implicitly describing. Of course, they knew about trade union leaders and they could contact trade union leaders, but the idea of them actually ministers actually talking to shop stewards, the people who had the inside knowledge. So when Tony, I first met him when he was in the working men's, unfortunately, clubs in the Northeast, talking to shop stewards, not just sort of patting on the back or winning their support as voters or recruiting them to the members, but encouraging them to draw up their ideas about how their industry could be transformed, how shipbuilding, how aerospace components could be transformed. And in the end, of course, he was crushed for that very, or, you know, in the end, forced to resign and moved on. For that very reason, that he was, in a way, what he was doing was more of a threat than endless paper documents calling for the nationalisation of the top 100 companies. It was that relationship that he was building up with workers as knowing agents of change. And I think, in a way, one had in that experience a kind of glimpse of what could be possible, of the kind of relationship that could make real transformation possible. I mean, it's happening now. I've got to rush, so I won't go into detail. I think that just to relate this, given this is a debate, the third way, I think the thing is that the third way is, insofar as it's a force in our lives anymore, I mean, it has given up on the social engineering state, but in my opinion, it's given up on social transformation as well. So you have this, I think, very uncomfortable situation, often sort of reading a lot of New Labour documents and finding a lot of the language of the New Left, empowerment, decentralisation, but the processes that they're empowering is not that the knowing agents at the base of society, the equivalent of the shop stewards that Tony Benn was working with, or the communities that we're familiar with now. It is an enabling of decentralisation that favours the forces of the market, which ends up as the big corporations. Now, this is it's contradictory, because I'll give it to New Labour. There are things they're doing that are about giving backup to local communities. I've been looking into New Deal for Communities, which is saying community-led must be the way in which regeneration is done. But because that's going alongside this acquiescence and support for the privatisation, in effect, of so many local services and other services, you get a situation where local communities support, in their community-led process, support reforming, for instance, council housing, vote for it, want it, only to find that government policies meant there's no money for council housing. It's all being housing's being shoved off to housing associations that are in the end sort of subject to the pressures of the financial market. Now, I can't go on much more, but I think the point of all this is to say that changing the notions of social transformation, getting away from the monopoly of the state and the party over that process, and actually creating a relationship which is supporting the forms of transformation that people themselves are beginning to organise, I think does make socialism, I mean, it answers the sceptic, it provides a viable strategy. I'll just give one more quote from Ralph, which I'm sure I'm allowed, where he talks about, quotes from Machiavelli, actually. So it's really Machiavelli I'm quoting. He says, "It must be considered that there is nothing more difficult to carry out more doubtful of success, nor more dangerous to handle than to initiate a new order of things. For the reformer has, I mean, and then he gives various reasons, including, you know, the enemies that the reformer has who profit by the old order. And then he ends up saying the other factor on making it so difficult is the incredulity of the people who do not truly believe in anything until they have had actual experience of it. And I think this notion of seeing social transformation as coming not only from the state, but through not spontaneous movements. And I think, you know, in the discussion we can explain the democratic law-governed nature of the relationship between a democratic socialist state and popular movements. But once one sees social transformation as coming from those movements, one can see that, and this is, I think, why the PT is being so successful, one can see why it is that people support socialist change in a country like Brazil, because they've actually had some experience, whether it's through the landless movement or the participatory budgets. The way the PT is organized has been to give support to the forms of transformation that people are bringing about in their own lives. Thanks.
Thanks, Hilary. I can't forget sitting in a sauna with Hilary, a public sauna with Hilary, wanting to discuss participation and democracy and all the other women. It was a women's only, looking at us with huge frowns. But anyway, thank you very much for an exciting argument. And now we have LSE's own director and author of The Third Way, Tony Giddens.
Let me say, first of all, I'm someone who sits before you in a posh suit. Hope it looks posh because I paid a lot of money for it, but it sort of goes with the job, I'm afraid, of being LSE director. Since I spend so much time asking the business people who Hilary just talked about for money to support this institution, let me say, first of all, how pleased I was to be invited to be on this panel, and again, congratulate Mike on having written really excellent and absorbing book, which I take is not just a biography of an individual, but an account of an age, an account of a whole post-war age. Unlike most other people on this panel, I can't say that I was a close friend of Ralph Miliband, but his life intersected with mine in ways which I didn't fully realize, because the book recounts how when he was at Cambridge, Ilya Neustadt was his main protector. Ilya Neustadt was also my main protector when I was a junior lecturer at Leicester, and I hadn't realized previously there was that thread of continuity. And Ilya gave Ralph some good advice. He said, breathe deeply and let a great calmness descend on you. I'm not sure he ever took that advice. I'm also one of the co-owners of Polity Press, and we were very pleased to be able to publish some Socialism for a Skeptical Age, and I was the one of the editors who worked directly on the manuscript, and of course it was a tragedy that Ralph died before the book was actually published. More latterly, just to complete the circle, I was very happy to play a part in helping establish the Miliband Program, which is helping to stage this event, and which has staged a large number of really great events at the LSE over the last little while. I feel I should just say a bit to flesh out what Mike said about Ralph's relationship to the LSE. I think it is true that the LSE shaped Ralph, because after all, he got his first degree here, he did his PhD here, and he had a very close relationship with Harold Lasky, albeit one in which he became critical of Lasky. But I like to think, like Mike does, that although Ralph said, and I noted this down after the 1960 events, it is difficult to convey the loathing I feel for the place. I sometimes feel like that. I shouldn't say that publicly, obviously. But I like to feel, and you know, he wouldn't come back even 25 years later, but I still think he was shaped by the LSE, because he never found another home after that and became much more of a wandering scholar after that date. Unlike, I think, most of my colleagues on the platform, I tend to think Ralph's most enduring contributions will come from or exist in his more sociological rather than his political writing. So I was someone who's weaned on the Miliband-Poulantzas debate, and that debate still has an impact, I think, on anyone who's involved in sociology and political science. And I think it's the state and capitalist society which, for me, will remain the core work of Ralph's career. Socialism for a skeptical age, well, I mean, I'm much more skeptical. Even though I did work on the manuscript, I was much more, and tried to, you know, give suggestions back about it. I'm much more skeptical of the arguments of that book than I think probably anybody else on this panel is today. And, you know, the theme of the book is that Marx's old mole is still burrowing, but I honestly don't think this is the case. Now, Hillary made a few remarks about the Third Way, which I'm very used to, sitting on platforms at the LSE. I think I can say with some certainty that I'm the only person on this platform who has some sympathy with New Labour. But I would like to say why. Why I do. And why I think, although New Labour obviously is a political programme, why I think the ideas underlying New Labour, as I would formulate them anyway, are a much more appropriate response to 1989 and after than the main arguments of socialism for a skeptical age are. Since there's not much time, let me just make two points about this. It's conventionally argued that New Labour has no ideological framework, that it has no driving thrust, but I would say almost completely the opposite. At least, you know, I would say from my own involvement with New Labour, I take it there is a robust intellectual programme which lies behind the transformations that New Labour has tried to put into practice in government. And that programme rests upon an appraisal of not just the consequences of 1989, which saw the end of the idea that you can substitute an organised, centrally organised economy for a competitive market economy, but also of the changes which brought that realisation about. The changes we have to cope with, anyone who stands left of centre today, are really fundamental. Globalization is not just an imaginary concept, it's real. The world is much more interdependent than it used to be, not just through the role of markets, but through the advance of communications and many other factors. Allusion was made to the knowledge economy, although as though this was a sort of invention. It is not. A generation ago, 42% of the population of this country worked in blue-collar manufacturing. Now only 16% of the population do, and the average for the European Union is only about 18%. Now, of course, you can make all sorts of arguments about people doing rather crummy jobs in service stations and all of that, but two-thirds of the jobs created by the knowledge economy are skilled jobs. They're not unskilled jobs. 80% of the population now have to get their living not through the manufacture of material goods. That's a tremendous transformation in the class structure of our societies. There's a rise of, I think, of a new form of individualism, not the same as selfishness, simply the capability and the desire to make our own lives. I don't think that can be reconciled with at least some forms of traditional collectivism. We also have to deal with the structural problems of the welfare state, which don't come just from declining revenue. They come from changes such as demographic changes, which have also transformed the population. There is a new agenda there. It doesn't seem to me, you can parrot phrases about continuity, but you must deal, I think, with those changes and find an agenda which allows one to use them positively rather than simply react in an entrenched negative way. Second, it's often said, New Labour succumbs to the power of markets. Well, that, you know, I don't stand here just to knee-jerk defend New Labour, but that isn't how I would see what, if you want to call it that, the Third Way or the New Social Democracy stands for. On the contrary, it stands for a renewed and robust defence of the public sphere, the key importance of public goods and public institutions in our lives, except that it argues that public goods and public institutions are not the same as the dominance of the state. The state often can be the enemy of public goods, wherever it serves entrenched interests, wherever it's corrupt, whether it's bureaucratic, many other reasons why this is so. There are many other ways of delivering public goods. Some of those involve not-for-profit organizations and so forth, other than the traditional state. And state control of industry, by and large, was not a great success. And anyone who, simple way, criticizes privatization must remember that there is a difficult boundary between what industries can be effectively privatized and semi or monopoly industries which are much more difficult to do that. But if you don't do that, you still have to deal with well-known difficulties which state control of industrial enterprise generate. These things having been said, this is why my view of the world will be almost totally different from that which Ralph Miliband sketched out in Socialism for a Skeptical Age. As an economic theory of the management of capitalism, which was where socialism essentially began, I think that form of socialism is dead. What are not dead are the ideals that inspired it, and we have to look for different policies for realizing those ideals and do so in a practical way by getting policies which allow left-of-center governments to get into power and to actually do things when they are in power. I would remind you the Labour Party has only been in power in this country for a handful of years over the past century. In closing, let me emphasize that I feel the spirit of Ralph Miliband is still alive and very important to us for three main reasons. One, we still need a critical engagement with capitalism. We still need to assert the necessity of active government and the continued role of the state, or albeit transformed role of the state, I think, in managing the problems which an unfettered capitalist economy gives rise to. And some of those problems are so obvious in the contemporary world at the moment. Second, what I call the power of utopia. I think you can't do without utopian thinking. But what one needs is what I would call utopian realism. You need an element of utopia, you need an idea of what a good society could be, but it should be linked to realistic policies. Anyone who simply promotes utopia without realism, as Marx of course said, is liable to have reactionary rather than progressive implications for the world. But thirdly, what I call the necessity of radicalism. But for me, radicalism, I think, means something different, I again imagine, from most of my colleagues here on the panel, because I don't identify radicalism with simply persisting with the ways of the old left. I regard it as being unafraid to change those ways, being unafraid to experiment with different policies and different ideals to serve the values of socialism, being unafraid to look at quite different ways of delivering on those values from the past. So I'm not in favor of waiting for the socialist millennium, and I'd just like to conclude by mentioning a sort of old Yiddish joke in which a man is sent to the city gates to wait for the millennium. And he says, big job, but at least the work is steady.
Oh, well, thanks. A very robust defense. And now, finally, I'd like to introduce Tony Benn, who needs no introduction, and I'm happy to say that he's now linked to the LSE.
Well, can I just say this about Mike Newman's book? It is a loving, sensitive, scholarly, and important book about a loving, sensitive, scholarly, and important person. That's what I feel about the book. And I think the references to Ralph's great friendship with his family and his sons reminds me, he once said to me before he died, he said, Tony, sometimes my children say to me, Dad, if everything you recommended were done, would it work? And I said, well, mine say the same to me. So he said, what a relief. And I thought that was very nice. But I want to look at slightly differently at the search for socialism. During the war, they used to say, dig for victory. Now, however deep you dug, you didn't find victory. You found a potato which allowed you to live long enough to see a victory. And this idea that you're searching for socialism is to me slightly strange. I must tell you, I was brought up on the Bible. My mother was a Bible scholar, and I was taught to believe that the Bible was the story of the conflict between the kings who had power and the prophets who preached righteousness. And I was taught to believe in the prophets and not the kings, and it's got me into an enormous amount of trouble ever since. But, you see, so I look at Marx as the last of the Old Testament prophets, a wise old Jew who sat in the British Museum and studied capital. Now, frankly, you could have written just as analytical book about capitalism without objecting to it. He said, here's the system, it's marvelous. You could have called it the second way, I don't know. But he did actually, the whole book is illuminated by passion against the injustice. I think Ralph was an Old Testament prophet. And I think we, the reason I say this, not to get involved into theological questions, which are extremely difficult, but to try and interpret Marx in a different way. You see, for me, what I've got from my commitment to socialism is a moral basis, not only from that, a historical perspective, which is now wiped out in modern politics. Nothing happened before 1994, as you know, the Labour Party didn't exist. They were all taxing and spending and all that. So no historical... I must say, when I thought of Gaitskell and Healy and Snowden doing nothing but taxing and spending, it did slightly confuse me. Historical perspective, tools of analysis are absolutely valuable, and some organisational advice as to how you could do it. And what I loved about the book, if I may say so, of course, I had a very different background from Ralph, but we're about the same age. I was born in a secure home, but, you know, I lived politically through that period. I remember the Spanish Civil War, I wrote an essay on it, which my teacher said was disgusting. I was against Franco. I went out in 1935 and I saw the fascists marching in London, led by Oswald Mosley, whom I'd first met in 1928 as a Labour MP, which I hadn't forgotten, and it frightened me. And so what the thing about this book and Ralph was that he analysed my own experience in a way that was so much more perceptive than my own analysis, and therefore illuminated my childhood retrospective. And I think of socialism as a route map and not a destination. Now, we have, of course, since the ideas that came into the public domain, we have had some experience of socialism. The Russian Revolution was exceptional. It born in war without a bourgeois democratic base, ended up, well, before it got very far, a war of intervention, which they don't teach you in the national curriculum. They never tell you that we went into Russia to try to destroy the revolution. A period of what is laughingly called appeasement, which is wholly untrue. There was no appeasement of Hitler. They were supported Hitler. The Western government supported Hitler. And if you read the captured German Foreign Office document, you'll find Halifax went to Berchtesgaden and said, Herr Chancellor, I'd like to congratulate you on the behalf of the British government for destroying communism in Germany and acting as a bulwark against communism in the Soviet Union. So the Cold War really began with the storming of the Winter Palace and ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And that was a dominant factor in the thinking of the Western governments. And the result, what came out of it, was something totally undemocratic, which, of course, Ralph was able to explain in those terms. The experience of social democracy is rather different. Began with the trade unions. Without Tolpuddle, you'd have never had the Chartists, and you'd have never had the suffragettes, and you'd have never had the welfare state, because the welfare state, people who were enfranchised, used the vote to buy the services they couldn't afford personally. And it was under democratic control, it was what they needed, and the vote became a currency. The currency of the poor was the vote, and they used it to buy what they needed. And, of course, when you take recent years, the years I was in Parliament from 1950, the Cold War was used to frighten people off socialism. I remember Nye's resignation speech when we were told we had to rearm and so on and so on. He said, the Russians don't intend to attack us, they haven't the power to attack us, and if we go for it, it'll end up with a witch hunt, and he was absolutely right. And they presented socialism as a military threat. And then, of course, the market was presented, market forces, as a liberator. I mean, did the American talk about democracy and market forces in one phrase? They regard the freedom of the market as the equivalent of democracy. Now that communism is gone, you see, what's happening is this. People see global capitalism, and they don't like it very much. They may not have wanted to go the Stalinist route, neither did I. But when they see the impact of globalization, particularly what is now known as armed globalization, that's the war against Iraq, where you send an army in to safeguard your interests in oil, they don't like it. And what my interpretation of I don't know whether you call it social democracy anymore. I don't want to use the word third way in a pejorative sense because I may have got it wrong. But what I notice is the system in Britain now is more authoritarian and centralized than ever it was. Only the state is now in support of capital instead of supporting labor. That's the way I see it. And today I came back from Belfast, and I know you could argue it's terrorism, but I was photographed as I got on and off the plane. Now, if we'd heard about that in Moscow, that would have been the final proof that communism was a police state. But really, you can bug your emails, open your letters, detain foreigners without trial. And when I think Mrs. Thatcher strengthened the state, and I think we've strengthened the state since the election. And it's very undemocratic. I mean, the great principle of the Chartists was you elected the people who governed you and you get rid of them if you didn't like. It's a very simple principle, whole basis of the constituency that you represent. You go there, everyone there employs you, you can say what you like and they can get rid of you, and therefore you have to listen to them. But the World Trade Organization, the IMF, which has destroyed so many third world countries by forcing them to privatize to get rid of debt, the Stability Pact, which even Prodi, not my favorite person, says he's stupid, which it is, because it controls an elected chancellor of the exchequer, and state power. And it is, after all, we were told recently at a recent conference, I won't identify which it was, but it was in Blackpool, that the purpose of the government was to take state power away and give it to localities. Well, take the firefighters' strike, the local authorities wanted to give 14%, so the state came in and said, no, you can't. I mean, it isn't logical. It doesn't follow its own protestations. And I think if you look at what's happened to the cabinet, I mean, you know, I'm a diarist. I believe the cabinet meets for half an hour every week, if there isn't any reason why it shouldn't. By which I mean a photo opportunity. But in January 1968, there were 8 full-day meetings of the cabinet. By God, it was a brilliant committee to sit on. I often lost, but when you lost, you lost because of some formidable minds turned to, and sometimes I won. And Parliament, you know, they could call Parliament back 2 days after the Queen Mother died, but they couldn't manage it with a war. It just isn't. It isn't rooted in the democratic spirit. And I think, I think power is back where it's always been, with money. Faith, I think the most powerful faith in the world is not Judaism, Christianity, Islam, it's the people who worship money. Much of them, look at the business news, every hour you're told what's happened to the FTSE, whatever that may be, and the Dow Jones Air. Well, what the hell can you do about it? You can't write to my MPs, I'm never voting for you because the FTSE's fallen. Why don't they publish figures about unemployment, homelessness, asbestosis, people who died? Why? Because those are the statistics that would allow you to press for change. And the thing is a worship, it is a religion. And of course the media are the modern church. I mean, Henry VIII nationalised the Church of England, as you know, because he wanted a priest in every pulpit every Sunday saying God wants you to do what the king wants you to do. Now the Tories nationalised the BBC. They wanted a pundit on every channel saying there's no alternative. But the media are now the whippers-up of war and also whippers-up against a lot of social progress. And of course, technology gives great power. Now, my feeling is, and this is why I go back to the socialism that's inspired me, you have to do it yourself. That's what Marx was saying. Don't wait for a kind king to pat you on the head and give you what you want. You have to organize. And that's the one thing that the Milbank Tower wasn't very keen on. I used to get a fax every day from the Milbank Tower as a member of Parliament. It used to come out of my fax machine. Tony Benn welcomes. I wondered what I'd welcome till I got the press release. And everything was the message, nothing from underneath up. And so I think you just have to work away at it. And if 1968 was a bit of a muddle, well, out of muddles can come good things. I dare say the Chartists were a bit of a muddle. Wouldn't be surprised if the suffragettes weren't a bit of a muddle. But out of it came pressure no government could resist. And that is what I believe Ralph encouraged. And finally, the sceptical age and all that, I don't believe that. I believe that there is a more receptive audience for arguing about democracy and internationalism and human rights and justice than there's been almost in my lifetime. Comparable to 1945 when I was a young guy campaigning. There's an audience waiting. We want these things dealt with. When's it going to be done? People say to me, what are you grumbling about? I say, I'm waiting for the election of a Labour government. It's a loyal comment to make, which I can honestly make. Now, the Labour Party was never a socialist party. But it always had socialists in it, just as there are some Christians in the churches. And I think what we want is more socialists in the Labour Party. And if we do that, I think the hope we can give, because hope is the fuel of progress and fear is a prison into which you put yourself. And I think Ralph, above all the things he did, was to give us hope and to do it with arguments based on integrity and a study of his own experience. Thank you very much.
I think, judging by the audience that's here and by the students I bumped into on the way here, we are in for another muddle, which I strongly look forward to. We've gone on much too long, but it was worth it because it was such a wonderful panel and all the speeches were so interesting. We've got to finish at 7, so my suggestion is...
Eight, sorry. You're in a muddle.
I'm in a muddle, as always. So my suggestion is that we have 10 minutes for people to raise questions, comments. Please make it short to give people time. And then we do a roundup of the panel just before 8. So who would like to come in? There are people going around the room with mics. I can't believe that people aren't bursting to say things. Oh, lots of bursts up there. But rather far. One down here. Is there a mic near? Oh, here comes the mic. What about this gentleman at the front here?
Yes, I think my voice is strong enough. The question is to each panel member. Could each panel member please mention the most successful socialist state in the 20th century according to her or his opinion? Thank you very much.
Great. Person at the back there with the beard. Eligible for leadership because he has a beard.
Thank you. I was privileged enough to take a course by Ralph Miliband many years ago at York University in Canada. And Ralph was always preoccupied with the agent of social change, the agency of revolution or radical change. And he reinterpreted the class structure of society in a way that would fit into his schema of social change. I wonder if the panel members have any thoughts about what could be the agent of change in this day and age.
Great. Now there's some more up there. I'm going to take the lady just here.
Thanks. I wanted to ask the panel members what they felt Miliband's response might have been to the current impending military situation. And also given the fact that the chair has alluded to student activity about the war that's likely to happen in the LSE, what their opinions are and where they feel that scepticism is being contributed to by the fact that people feel they have to take direct action when they're not being listened to by the current government on the issue of this war.
Okay, what is the person beside you? And then there's one at the back.
I wondered if the panel could comment on the strength of individualist values in Western society today, and which are enshrined in neoliberal economics especially. I wondered how the panel could discuss how can a more complex conception of freedom within socialism take hold and maybe usurp this current status quo.
I want to ask Professor Penish two questions. Firstly, in your opinion, what's the most distinguished characteristics in socialism which is superior than capitalism? Secondly, how do you compare the communism in China to your idealistic socialism?
Now, do we have anybody else? Yes, the gentleman at the front here.
I wonder if the panel could briefly comment on two, it seems to me, major issues in relation to the question of social improvement and movement to social justice, which have only been very briefly touched on hitherto. The first is taxation, its importance and how to get it. The second is the media, how to deal with them.
Okay, and the lady here.
Me?
Yeah.
I was just interested in the panel's view of the, I suppose, the fall of the citizen and the rise of the consumer in terms of, I suppose, affecting change of on issues such as GM foods and, you know, just policies there that initially Labour were, you know, for GM and then, you know, as a result of organised protests through NGOs and so on, it changed. So consumer or citizen?
I think we have one more here, and then we're probably coming to the end. I can't see anymore. It's amazing how everybody upstairs has been.
My question is quite hopefully quite simple. Is there a contradiction between focusing on equality or ownership? Thank you.
Okay, well, we've got an enormous list of questions, and I think I'll go backwards. I'll start with Tony Benn and end with Leo.
Yes, Pennish. The most socialist state was the National Health Service. Don't look for it somewhere else. There was. We were bankrupt. We hadn't two pennies to rub together. It was absolutely free, no prescription charges, no charge for teeth and spectacles. It was the most socialist and the most popular thing we ever did. So don't look for other countries. It's what we've done there. Popular pressure will bring it about. I mean, that's the answer, because governments, even though they may not notice, take much notice of the Labour conference, the spin doctors look at the opinion polls, and we may have to get at the leadership through the opinion polls, which is a slow way, but I think that is what will happen. On war, you ask about that. I mean, I don't know how to put it. I would not like to have on my conscience that within a few days I would order a war that would make widows in Baghdad and children orphans in Iraq in pursuit of a war for oil. I put it as simply as that. And I think that the LSE students have a tremendous job in trying to help people to get it across, because for me that's a terrible thing to do. I mean, it's a scale of decision making that takes it out of any other criticism I might have of a Labour leader. On taxation and the media, I think a much larger element of redistributive taxation is essential and people would accept it. You don't want a state-controlled media. But the media problem is they don't report what people are saying at the bottom. That is the problem. I was with Jack Jones last year, and 2,000 pensioners in Blackpool, and after all, 11 million of us. I said to Jack, this huge rally will not be reported unless you take this brick and throw it through McDonald's. And if you do, there will be a bishop on Newsnight talking about the rising tide of violence among old people. And he didn't. Because he didn't throw the brick and it wasn't discussed. The media, and then, you know, in 10 years' time, the BBC will get an award at Cannes for a programme, How We Got It Wrong in Iraq. Why can't they help us now? They're doing that about the Suez War. Anyway, consumer, yeah, I'm a little doubtful about consumerism, because once you think of yourself as consumers, then if you haven't got any money, you can't be a consumer. And customers have the same effect. To be a customer, you have to have money. And so they found a word that eliminates the poor. So we're citizens, we're patients, we're travelers, we're voters, but we're not really, I would not like to be judged by what I consume. I don't know whether others would, but I would have a very harsh judgment on me if you knew what I ate and the state of my laundry and other things. So forgive me, that's my answer.
Tony.
I'll just comment on a few of these interesting questions. First of all, I think, you know, these are serious questions, and so try and give serious answers to them. I think there's a big and clear distinction between being a consumer and being a citizen, and the two are not the same. To be a citizen is not the same as to have the rights to roam the aisles of a supermarket. Citizen is defined in the public sphere, and it's really important to see that that is something quite different from consumer rights. I think consumer rights are much more important than Tony Benn acknowledges, however, because they give you all sorts of chances to influence your own destiny. This appeals also to poorer people, I think, as well as to richer ones, so I wouldn't be so dismissive of that. Nor would I have the media, because I think media have like a double role in our lives, because I think if you look at the extension of democracy across the world, which is one of the things that is characteristic of the current age, spread of democratic governments across the world, albeit quite often insecure, I think you have to say the opening out of public space by the media, proliferation of media, communications on a global scale has played a part in that. The media do give us in principle the chance of publicly debating crucial issues in our lives. On the other hand, as we all know, the media relentlessly close down those very spaces they open up by kind of relentless trivialization of the news, personalization of the news, endless stories about Ulrika and so forth. All these things surely need to be contested by us, I think. And I don't see this as an impossible task, because I think there are ways of producing a much more responsible media than we have in this country. I don't see why it's compatible with democracy that you have large chunks of the media owned by two people who are not British citizens and who are trying to stop us getting into the euro. I don't think these things are compatible with democratized media institutions, and they should be contested. On the military situation in Iraq, I mean, and like many people here, I feel strongly about this. I feel we live in a world which is a globalized world, and in that world, multilateralism is the only approach to it. I'm quite disturbed by the actions of the current American administration, and I'm strongly against any kind of unilateral American involvement in Iraq, and strongly in favor of getting the weapons inspectors back there with the clearest possible mandate, and I feel all of us should support that policy. Finally, agents of social change. You know, my view of that would be quite different from Ralph Miliband, because I wouldn't look for the traditional agents of social change, but I would say lots of changes happen in the world. They happen because of the impact of social movements. I don't think you want to call it muddle, because it's okay to have muddle, you know, when everyone's thinking about ideas, but you don't want your phone system to be a muddle. You don't want your railway system to be a muddle. You want things to be organized and function effectively. The main agents of social change, or some of the main ones, are still social movements, I think. And most of the core aspects of changes that have happened in our lives, for example, affecting gender relations, rise of the feminist movement, ecological thinking, rise of the green movement, consumer movements also have a part to play, I think, and a range of social movements which essentially, to me, force things on the agenda. That's what they do. Social movements force things on the agenda, but you don't want to be governed by them. They're unelected themselves, and therefore there's no substitute for good old-fashioned democracy in the way in which you run an effective society locally, nationally, or globally, in my opinion.
Hillary.
Well, on the citizen-consumer thing, I think the point you were making about is about the way in which consumers are becoming organized, like over GM foods, like over sweated labour in Nike and other companies. And I think, in a way, what that shows is that the citizen will out. I mean, in a way, what those consumers are doing, are organising, using their consumer power and, in a way, playing on the vulnerability of the companies because of the importance of the brand. So the consumer has a power, not so much because of their individual purchasing power, but because of the counter-publicity that they can create, which does weaken the company's position in the market. I mean, you saw it with McDonald's, the fact that they, you know, took that incredibly expensive libel action against two people producing very scruffy leaflets shows the potential bargaining power. But it's consumers organising because of the lack of democratic control over those companies. So it's consumers getting organised and acting as citizens. I mean, it's good to hear Tony talk very supportively about social movements, actually sort of setting the agenda. In a way, the ecological movement has set, and consumers, ethical and environmental consumers, have set the agenda on GM food. But I mean, what the government does is not follow that agenda. In the end, the government has sided with the GM corporations. And that's what I mean by this point about enabling and empowering. I mean, the left that I'm defending, and I think Ralph was arguing for in that last chapter when he talked about the alliance between government and therefore ineffectively party and grassroots movement, was not the old left. He was questioning the old left. His conception of the state wasn't a sort of monopoly view of the state as an agent of social change. And he was beginning to talk, and certainly I'm arguing for forms of social transformation which are not monopolized by the state. The problem, the key thing, is forms of transformation that are democratic. And if you empower the corporations, which is, I feel, what New Labour is ultimately doing, it's doing a lot of good things, supporting community, you know, you support social movements, but when it comes down to it, you know, I mean, I've just observed it, you know, communities want a swimming pool. They can't have a swimming pool because the local government is so starved of money, it's had to accept a takeover bid by Serco, you know, so there's no possibility of a swimming pool responding to that movement. Anyway, I won't waffle on about that. But on the point about what kind of state, I mean, I don't think there's any, I mean, I suppose I agree with Tony about the NHS, but I'd also point to examples of this new kind of relationship that actually are mainly in localities, because that's where it's been possible for social movements to establish a different relationship with the state. So Bologna, you know, really important developments there where the women's movement got the backing of the state for a new way of organising nurseries, not private control, but public control, democratic control, but run through users and workers backed by public funding. The GLC, you know, that wasn't an old left state. I mean, Norman Tebbit said, you know, this is modern socialism, we must kill it, which he did, aided considerably by Neil Kinnock and members of the front bench of the Labour Party. So, you know, that sort of, the Porto Alegre in Brazil, that relationship between the state, which is necessary for redistribution, for, I think, you know, dealing with the media, you need the breakup of those monopolies, you need the regulation of those monopolies, then that'll allow a whole lot of grassroots, bottom-up processes to flourish. Better stop.
Thank you. I think they were an excellent set of questions because they posed the questions that I think the third way evades. Sorry, they posed the questions that the third way evades and consistently evades. I must say that the notion that Ralph had, or that the labor left that Tony represented, had an image of the nationalized industries that was merely positive rather than critical, I can't credit. I mean, one simply has to go back to what they wrote and what they said about those nationalized industries, how undemocratic they were, who got on the boards and how they got there, the alienation that workers working in them felt from them, the alienation that women dependent on welfare felt from the agencies that gave them welfare, although they needed it. Those were the themes. As for what agents have changed, Ralph wasn't someone who, in any sense, put the old industrial proletariat at the center. The labor movement was at the center, but that was not a labor movement that was cast in steel workers and miners alone. Any one of his sociological contributions is about the growing size of the service sector and the state sector and how different those workers are. What is the fact, however, and this does relate to this question of equality and ownership, is that the people that go in and work for these corporations, no matter how highly educated they are as technicians, go into a hierarchical, disciplined organization, one in which there is not a smidgen of democracy, not a smidgen of it. To get a job, no matter how highly educated you are, no matter how much of a knowledge worker you are, you give up your right to have any say in what is produced, how it's produced, under what conditions produced, and increasingly, how many hours you work. And that is evaded, evaded. And to speak of equality and even equality of opportunity, when most people work in these fundamentally undemocratic places, is, to me, not serious. And the same applies to consumers. There is the greatest problem with consumers, and the term needs to be contested, obviously, is not only that they don't have a great deal of control, except in the supply and demand such sense, where there is some, over what they actually consume, but the great problem is in our consumer society. How can we think of ourselves as egalitarians so long as we in the North go on to consume as much as we do? We can't conceivably do that. And if it is said that even if we distributed what we have far more than we do, that would not solve the problem of poverty in itself, that is not enough of a reason not to do it. Stafford Cripps went to the TUC in 1948 to make an appeal for wage control. I sat in the LSE library and I read his speech. The argument that he made was that even if we took all of the wealth away from the wealthy and distributed it to the rest of the population, it wouldn't increase most Britons' incomes all that much. And he was right, but that wasn't a reason not to do it. In fact, it would have changed the very spirit of post-war Britain had more of that been done. Although some of it was done by that government. Much more should have been done. But in response to his appeal for wage restraint, and this gets to the point about pressure from below, a woman cleater from the T&G, worked at Whitehall, went to the mic and said, Stafford Cripps may be able to live on radish tops and orange juice, but he can't expect the British working class to do the same. You don't hear much of that at Labour Party conferences anymore. That parliament of the labour movement. I don't think that I agree with Tony that the NHS represented the pinnacle of socialism. it wasn't democratic enough. And I don't think we've seen any example of socialism that has been democratic enough, although I think one has to say that one of the reasons for it, that does have to do with the kinds of pressures that have existed on a country like Cuba that have made it quite undemocratic, more than the inclination of its leaders might have been, although heaven knows they weren't democratic enough. What is the fundamental characteristic in socialism that is superior to capitalism? I think it is a conception that the full development of human beings ought to come and possibly can come through cooperation rather than through competition. Oh, China. The communist capitalist elite of China. They're turning themselves into a bourgeoisie in a very venal way. What more can one say?
Well, thanks, everybody. That was a wonderful debate. And we'll see you soon.